When it comes to your feet, eBay's got your back. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, real experts are checking your sneakers. Every stitch, down to the sole. Personally, I can't wait to get a new pair of Giannis Freak 5s. Whatever you're adding to your lineup next, head to eBay. From the drop to your doorstep, eBay doesn't play games with your sneaker game. Just look for that blue checkmark. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit eBay.com for terms.
Coming up next on Inside Golf Podcast, Jeff Willett, professional caddy on the PGA Tour for Luke Lest, also formerly Nick Taylor, amongst others. Jeff has been around for a while, and we touch on everything from the Masters to Luke winning at Torrey Pines to Luke's infamous putting at times and a caddy's perspective on LIV, Luke getting an offer from LIV, and much more. Jeff is an awesome guy, a really thoughtful dude, and it was fun to sit down with him and dive into all sorts of stuff. Before we get to Jeff, this podcast is presented, as always, by RickRunGood.com. RickRunGood.com is a fantasy golf and golf betting database with a ton of different tools, including a model and lineup generator, DraftKings ownership projections. It pretty much has every stat you could possibly want, including Korn Ferry Tour data, LIV data, PGA Tour data, stroke scan data from Euro Tour events, not to mention premium long-form written articles from myself. I do a full course breakdown on Mondays, an in-depth DraftKings preview where I break down the weather and ownership before every DraftKings slate on Wednesdays, premium Slack channel where you can hit me up for any questions, and much more. So head on over to rickrungoods.com. Promo code Andy so they know I sent you, and we'd love to have you as part of the community. All right. Without further ado, let's bring on Jeff. All right. Jeff Willett is here, caddy for Luke Lest on the PGA Tour. You're in Napa right now. Is this, I got to ask, how's Napa been? I'm down in LA and it's been pretty hot, but I assume I caught a little bit of coverage today and it looks beautiful out there.
Yeah, it was nice. We all started warming up this morning. Everything was great. And all of a sudden, a huge fog bank came in.
Right.
And it caused an hour and 30-minute delay. But that's normal here. The fog just seems to roll in out of nowhere in Napa. And I know we missed the heat wave last week. I guess it was 100+.
It was bad.
But I was freezing this morning. I'm not going to lie to you. I was out there in the dark this morning on the putting green setting up his putting drills, and I was freezing at 6:15, and we hung around in the fog for 3 hours. So, once it lifted, everything was great, but I was freezing. Everybody calls me soft, and I'm from Maine. I mean, I am soft.
Would you call this one of, like, the more widely favorited between player and caddy stops on the PGA Tour?
I think a lot of the tour wives love to come here.
Yeah.
I think, I know Luke and his wife came out without their kids on Sunday, and they did the three or four place wine tasting deal on Monday. Had a really good time, said he needed it. But I know a lot of the tour wives love to come here and order a bunch of wine.
That's what I've heard. Well, I want to backtrack before we talk more about, Napa and what's going on with Luke this upcoming year. How'd you get into this, man? Take us back. How long have you been doing this for Luke, and kind of give us the rundown on a little bit of your background?
Sure. This is the start of my 22nd year on tour. I was playing the mini tours down in South Florida back in the late 90s, early 2000s. And a friend of mine made it on, he actually went to qualifying school and made it through all three stages of Q school, which was unbelievable. He went from the mini tours to the PGA Tour in a matter of 3 months. He went out to the West Coast, didn't make a dime, didn't make a cut. And he came back for the Honda Classic. And I got a phone call on Monday morning and asked me if I wanted to work the Honda And I said, well, sure, absolutely. So I went down to work the Honda, and, you know, the weather was incredibly bad. And we were, honestly, we didn't know what round we were in. We were just delayed all over the place. And he shoots 64, 65, 66, and I end up in the last last group with Kuchar and Mike Weir. It's my first ever event. We're in the last group. He shot a couple over, finished 19th, but it was an incredible experience. And I knew right then that I liked it on this side of the bag a lot more than playing wise. So we continued and we played the rest of the year, and he just barely missed his card. Really a tragic story at qualifying school. He double bogeyed his 105th hole. It was a six round deal back then. To miss his card by a shot, and he ended up, you know, down to the, I think it was the web.com at that time, but I decided I was going to stay out on the PGA Tour, and I made my own way, and, you know, 22 years later, here I am still.
How'd you meet Luke? Does it kind of work in a sense where once you are a caddy on the PGA Tour and you're kind of in between jobs, and players obviously switch caddies a bunch, and you guys kind of just find each other?
Yeah, it's a pretty small world out here. I mean, it's a traveling circus with the media and the caddies and the players and the officials. But realistically, there's 156 players and 156 caddies. There's really not much. So news travels fast. When Nick Taylor, I was working for Nick Taylor for almost 6 years. And
yeah, great player.
He had his best year ever. We won Pebble wire to wire. And I don't know, it just went south. I don't know really how it happened, and we parted ways. And I've always noticed Luke was an incredible player. And I noticed he was kind of bouncing around. So I called his coach, and literally within 3 hours of getting let go by Nick Taylor, I had had Luke List. So it's really strange how it works out here. News travels incredibly fast. So it's just a really kind of a networking deal.
So when Luke won Torrey, that was not your first win on the PGA Tour. You had won Pebble, which was quite another great place to win. I think you were, was Phil in the final group that year? Or?
Yes, we had like a 3-shot lead going on to the final round, and Phil was the closest. And Nick played incredible. He won wire to wire. It was great. I remember telling him coming off the range, I was like, listen, I know the crowd is going to be all for Phil, so it's just me and you out here. And Nick went out there and played incredible. I mean, really dominated. We had a 6-shot lead making the turn, and it was great. Took down Phil. And I like Phil. But, yeah, so with Luke winning tour, that was my third win with three different players, which is really cool.
Who is the other one?
I won with Brian Bateman. We won the Buick Open and Warwick Hills in
okay.
Michigan.
Okay.
Back in 2007.
Yeah, I assume Torrey was the only one where you guys were worried about darkness, and you had this. I think he shot something like a 66, right, in the final round and finished early, and then you guys are waiting for 2 hours. What was that like?
Well, when he made that, I wish there was a camera on, because I had the flag and I was kind of standing beside him, and I knew it was a big putt on 18, and he drained it, and I knew it. I gave it just a tiny little fist pump, and because I knew that was big, because it was, the weather was getting cooler. Mm-hmm. It wasn't blowing really hard, but at Torrey, it was blowing 6-8 miles an hour. But when it's cold, it feels like 20 miles an hour in other places. So I knew it was going to be tough for the guys coming in to make any birdies at all. Luke didn't have any confidence that it was going to hold up at all.
Really?
I thought for sure he didn't at all. He thought he went in, had a meal or whatever, and he came out 30 minutes later. He's like, "Al, you know, I don't know if this is going to hold up." I said, "I really think this is going to hold up. I really do." And obviously, it was tight coming down the stretch with Rahm and Zalatoris. we had to avoid those two guys basically, but nobody really did anything. Zalatoris missed that putt and Rahm missed his putt. And after 2 hours of hitting balls, we were in the playoff. And when we went out to that playoff, it was dark.
It was dark. I was standing there by the 18th green. It was dark. You had 10 minutes, maybe.
We did. And it was cold. I could not believe how cold that cart ride was to 18T. I was freezing. And obviously we both hit it in that bunker, both buried. It was, we tried to decide who was playing first. And Luke hit an incredible shot out of a buried lie. And then I don't know if you saw it, but my rake job went viral. the tour official was going to make me rake this ball or rake the bunker. And I kept telling him, I said, listen, you rake this. I don't want to hit his ball. So every rake stroke I made, the crowd was oohing and aahing. And it was unbelievable. But, to go back to regulation, Luke drove it in the rough, and then he laid up in the rough, and we had 120 yards or so. I've seen more bogeys and double bogeys made from that layup in the rough to the 18th, to 18th pin than I've seen birdies ever. And for somehow, some way, he muscled this ball onto the green past the hole and canned that putt, which was amazing. I mean, obviously his shot in the playoff was amazing too, 6 inches, but the regulation nothing would have ever happened if he wouldn't have hit that shot out of the rough. I mean, I was nervous. I was like, this could go anywhere. This could go long, this could go in the water, but I somehow got it on the green and made the putt. I mean, it was a really great thing and I'm really happy for him, for his first win. It was really special.
Is Torrey one of the places every year where it feels like that's such a course I remember just from I spend all my time looking at the numbers and the statistics of it all. And heading into that week, because he had a really good fall swing. I mean, he was scratching the surface on, I think he was in the mix. I think he went 7th Zozo, 10th RSM, 11th US Open, 17th Sanderson Farms. And that's a good golf course for him. I think you want Luke List on golf courses where you're going to have driver in your hands a lot. It's a little bit longer. You're going to have a long iron in your hands a lot. Did you guys feel like you were kind of on the precipice of something?
I did. I did for sure. I mean, honestly, we should have won 3 times in the fall, and that's no lie. Putting, he really had a good chance at Zozo. Houston was really, really close. And, we finished 10th at Sea Island, where 10th was like the highest he could have finished. So, barring the putting issues aside, he was playing incredibly well. And he's always thought that he could win at Torrey. He really has always wanted to win at Torrey. It's a great golf course for him. It's long. It really eliminates 3/4 of the field, honestly. And, the way he hits it and as long as he is, he's always wanted to win there. And it built through the fall and through the West Coast swing right up to there. And he came through.
You alluded to the putting a little bit. And I emailed you about this a little bit on the outline. But, if you look at the numbers, he hits the ball well enough to be a top 20 player in the world. I mean, it's really that good. I mean, the consistent level of ball striking that he has put together over the last 2-3 years, I mean, it's up there. And obviously the putter has been the one thing that's held him back. Does he feel that way? Like, is there a sense, does he realize how good he is with the ball striking and kind of, does he have that frustration too? Or sometimes I look at the stats and some of the players will say, you guys are overrating the stats. I'm really confident in this part of my game.
He's I've worked for a lot of ball. Fortunately and unfortunately, I've worked for some incredible ball strikers in my career and not incredible putters. Luke ranks, I would put him into the top 10 or maybe even top 5 in the world of ball striking. It's a sight to see. His ball striking is incredible. When it comes to putting, I think we might have turned the corner here in the last month or so to where he used to worry about the stroke and where the mechanics of the stroke instead of worrying about, you know, knocking in a 3-footer. And I think we're kind of turning the corner to where he's not quite as worried about the stroke anymore. So I'm hoping to see improvements. And listen, I'm not going to say that Luke's ever going to be a top 10 putter on tour. I think if we could get to, say, 75th on tour, he would make $10 million a year.
Oh, yeah.
And that's no joke. That's no joke, the way he hits it. He doesn't have to be the best putter on tour. He just has to be a little better than average. And it's held him back. It has over his career. There's no doubt about it. But I've seen him have some really good putting weeks, and I've seen some bad putting weeks. But for example, last fall, his bad putting weeks, we finished 10th and 7th. And
he lost 6 strokes putting at the Houston Open and finished 11th. I mean, if he's a neutral putter, he wins that tournament.
That's exactly right. I mean, obviously everybody knows about his minus 8, whatever it was
at
the BMW this year.
Does he find out about that? Like, because I know it reverberates through our world, but do you guys catch wind of that stuff?
Yeah, unfortunately, there was an article written. I don't know if it was golf.com. I don't want to get anybody in trouble, but I was really upset, you know, at him calling out Luke and having a putting day like he did. But another reporter came up to him after the second round because he had a much better
he bounced back. He gained like 3.5 the next day, which is the funny part of it.
He did. And he, yes. So to answer your question, we know, and they know, and he knows. It's unfortunate that it has to be that way sometimes out here because, you know, media, social media, it gets around quick. But, you know, like I said, I think we might be turning a corner when it comes to putting. Now he's got a new putting coach and we're working, not mechanically wise, but his stroke is really, really good. And I think once he gets to the point to where he doesn't think about if he's doing it right or wrong, you know, he's always wondering if the stroke is right. There's got to be something right or wrong. And we're trying to convince him now that it's right. And, you know, if we can get him, that's half the battle. You know, putting. I mean, it's tough and it's big out here. Some weeks, it's a putting contest, and you know, some weeks it's a ball striking contest. So, but yeah, you know, it was tough. Last fall could have been magical, really, honestly. You know, I think he 3-putted 7 times at Sea Island. We finished 10th. We were in 5th coming into Houston. Double bogey the last hole. Missed a short one. Missed a 1-footer. To finish 9th. So yeah, it all comes down to putting, whether it's Luke List or anybody else out there. You've got to make putts.
Are you familiar with Rotella at all? Cause that sound, he seems very, my biggest problem with putting too is I'm so focused on the technicalities of it. And Rotella is really good at preaching. Like he's like all feel, throwing a baseball. You're not thinking about anything, and it's really helped me actually.
I believe it. Yeah, and that's where we're trying to get now. I mean, that's where we're trying to, you know, we know what happened last year. We do. It could have been a really special year, but I think we're trying to turn that corner to get to where he doesn't think about anything mechanical, and it's all that he knows the stroke is good. He knows the stroke is there. And he's able to just pour in the 3-footers and the 4-footers and the 5-footers to where that's where everything is made on this tour. because everybody is just so good. So hopefully we've turned that corner. But yes, I agree with Rotella. I do like a lot of his theories, and it's just we're hoping that we can get to where we need to be when the putting, like I said, just be average.
Yeah.
Just be average.
Yeah. Is he very technical in general? Is he very, you know, looking at his stats, a lot of work with the TrackMan, a lot of work with the swing coaches, or is he a little bit more kind of feel based?
I'd like to see him be more feel based with his swing, because the swing is so simple.
And it's beautiful.
So smooth. Yeah. And just so powerful.
Don't change a thing there.
That's exactly right. So I think he looks a little bit too technical sometimes, but when it's really good and he feels that it's good, then it's all natural. So we try to get with the TrackMan, it's mostly about numbers and not technical stuff. It's not about smash factor and all that kind of stuff that guys look for. It's mostly about numbers and what it's flying, a particular place in the country that we're at. It's not like over technical. I don't think he plays golf swing out there most of the time. I think for the most part, it's really an awesome sight to see Luke Liss hit a golf ball.
Fifth on tour in club head speed, sixth in driving distance, seventh in off the tee, second in approaches from 250 yards plus, 11th in greens in regulation. Yeah.
It's impressive. It really is impressive.
And you know what's interesting? Just looking over at his stats page too, he's actually top 50 in putting longer than 20 feet. So he's not a bad lag putter. And I have a stat that I look at called approach putting, which kind of measures the distance that you leave yourself on putts greater than 25 feet. It's pretty high in that. It's just the 189th in putting 4 to 8 feet. That's what kills us.
That's exactly right. His touch from 20 feet, 30 feet, 40 feet is incredible. He has incredible touch and feel.
Yeah.
So he's always going to put himself into a place where it's tap in. Well, tap in out here, you know, 3 feet.
Right.
Somewhere around that area. His touch is incredible. Obviously, the stats don't lie. You know, where he struggled was, you know, from 3 to 5 feet and maybe 2 to 5 feet. He really is a great putter when it comes to 25 feet for birdie. I mean, he's made a lot of putts and he a lot of tap-ins. So yeah, he obviously knows where he has to improve, you know, he wants to be an elite player, and he is an elite player. It's just, he's so close to going to the top level, like the elite level. It's, you know, hopefully, like I said, I hope that, you know, it's coming around. I really do.
What's the on-course relationship like with you guys? When you were talking about that, it made me think, like, are you out there reading greens for him a lot? Are you super hands-on, or kind of more you guys have this built-in trust?
I'm more of a Luke manager, you know? So I don't read many putts. I read maybe one or two a week. He's a really good green reader, reads them very well. I'm more out there trying to keep him on the rails. He's an emotional player. He's a perfectionist. When things, just the smallest things, could set him off and get him off, you know, off the rails. So I'm more of a loop manager. You know, obviously I do the numbers and the clubs and all the stuff that a caddy does, but I'm more sports psychologist out there and trying to keep him focused on, you know, if he three putts or missed a short putt or hits a bad shot, I'm just trying to get him refocused on to the next shot, to where it doesn't carry on a hole or two holes or three, you know what I mean? Where we get, you know, 3 or 4 holes in a row to where, and then all of a sudden he snaps back into it and he's back into his round. So that's more my important job, I would think, is to be a Luke manager.
What's the week look like for you? Like in terms of getting there? Are you getting there early? Are you walking the course beforehand? What is it? What is a typical, you know, Monday through Wednesday before the tournament starts actually look like for you?
Yeah, Monday's a travel day. We get there on Monday. He doesn't do much on Mondays. So if it's a course that I've been to 20 times, I may go out and just see if the rough's thick, if it's firm. I'm not going to go out and do a lot of scouting unless it's a brand new golf course that we haven't seen. Then I'll go out there and do all the work that I need to be done. But I'll just go familiarize myself with the golf course that I've seen a lot, you know, because he's going to come out and he's like, you know, how's the rough? You know, the rough's thick. How are the greens? The greens are firm or the greens are soft. So I need to know those answers when he comes out on Monday afternoon to putt or on Tuesday morning. But mostly Monday's a travel day and do a little bit of work on Monday. And then on Tuesdays, it's now with these pro-ams are mostly nine holes.
Yeah.
So we'll do a little bit of practicing, whether it's in the morning or afternoon, whatever. And we'll play nine holes, the nine that we're not playing the next day on Wednesday in the pro-am. And then on Wednesdays, we'll play the pro-am and pretty much get ready for Thursday. So, I mean, it sounds a little simple. It is a lot. It's a lot of work. I mean, it's long days on Tuesdays, you know, pretty long days on Wednesdays. So it's a pretty full week.
Did you, was this your first Masters going out to Augusta for the first time?
No, that was my third.
Okay. Cause you probably went with Nick after he won Pebble.
We played the fall Masters that COVID year
that DJ won.
That
course played, as you know, I'm sure, played a lot differently that year than it did the past year or two.
I really felt bad for Nick. It was his first Masters with no crowd. It was soft and it was incredibly hot. It was nothing like
you're going up against football. Yeah, it's in a weird time slot.
On number six on the par three. The pin was right on that back right shelf, and he hit a shot just left of the hole where normally that would come down all the way to the front left when it stuck up there, and he made two, which it would have been a four or a three or four, you know, on a normal Masters. I really felt bad for the guys that were, especially Nick, you know, his first Masters. It was nothing like a real Masters. Like, for example, Luke and I, this April, it was a real Masters. They got to skip the ball across on 16, you know, the crowd, because we were on 15 in the fall Masters and Rahm was ahead of us. We were hitting our second shot into 15 and Rahm had skipped it, the back left pin. He skipped it across the pond and it went in. And we heard, you know, it was a pretty loud roar for about 30 people out there. But normally that would have been, you know, 5,000 people around that green. It would have been a roar. Everybody would have heard an amazing shot, an incredible moment, but they kind of got stolen from them. I'm not saying it shouldn't have happened, the Masters that time, but it was tough for the first timers. I felt bad for them.
What was that like with Luke going back this year? Because he hadn't, I think he came as an amateur in like 2005. And actually made the cut and finished T33. And then he hasn't been back since this year.
Yeah, I think it was the longest stretch between Masters
17 years
ever. You know, he lives in Augusta now. And, you know, his wife's from Augusta. I think there was a lot of pressure on him to perform in front of, you know, his friends and family. And he just didn't play. And the weather was, we got the afternoon wave on Thursday was incredibly hard. It was blowing 30 miles an hour.
Yep.
And then the front went through. And then the next day it was freezing cold and blowing. It's not an excuse. But it is a factor. It was incredibly hard, you know, to factor in home course or hometown. And the bad draw, it was a tough week.
I really hope you guys make it back this year, because on paper, and I had this thought about Oak Hill too when I played it with our mutual friend Don, which we could talk about too, but on paper, that should be a really good course for him, right? I mean, I think that it should, because, you know, obviously there's a lot of undulation to the greens, and it's a course where, you know, you're going to need to be able to putt and you're going to need to have a lot of experience on those greens. But from tee to green, like, that is a course where, again, somewhat similar to Torrey, he's going to have a lot of long irons. He's going to have a lot of drivers. Honestly, major championships in general, I would think would be a really good spot for him, because those are the types of courses that tend to devalue, you know, you hear about these putting contests at the Amex and stuff like that. Like, the majors are kind of the inverse of that, where there's so much more of an emphasis on ball striking.
I thought for sure, and, you know, I didn't say this to many people, but I thought Luke was going to be a favorite, or was a favorite at Augusta.
Yeah.
I really did. The way he drives it, I thought we could get to every par five, no problem. It just didn't work out that way. It was incredibly difficult. The PGA at Southern Hills this year, he played pretty well on another golf course that's extremely demanding from tee to green. He played decent. He did. But I think the majors is a big focus for him now. Now that he played in all four of them last year, I think that's a big, big goal of his and ours, to get back to the majors. And having that experience, I know he's played in majors before and stuff, but I think now that he's a more established player, and I think the majors is a big key for him. And I know he's keying on the invitationals and the majors to, you know, to make his career, really.
Were you with him for Bethpage in 2019?
No.
Yeah. That's another, it's just another one of those golf, like, if you, it's interesting with him. If you look at the courses where he's had the most success, Corrales, 1.57 per round. That's a long golf course where you hit driver a lot. Torrey, Country Club of Jackson, which you guys have gotten a couple of weeks, another longer golf course where you hit driver a lot. Bay Hill, he's been really good at, gains over a stroke at Bay Hill. And Memorial Park, which you guys had a legitimate chance to win this past year. All those golf courses are over 7,400 yards, right? And that's kind of what you're seeing with a lot of these major championships too. I mean, what's his carry distance?
Philip has just lost the respect of the youth league football team he coaches. He was asked what New England should do in the draft, and his answer was objectively terrible. The Athletic just wrote a great article about this, but Philip doesn't have the Athletic or the respect of a boisterous group of 11-year-olds who once looked up to him. Learn from Philip's error, get the Athletic, and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
When it comes to your feet, eBay's got your back. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, real experts are checking your sneakers, every stitch down to the sole. Personally, I can't wait to get a new pair of Giannis Freak 5s. Whatever you're adding to your lineup next, head to eBay. From the drop to your doorstep, eBay doesn't play games with your sneaker game. Just look for that blue checkmark. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit eBay.com for terms.
I he's carrying it 320.
Yeah. So I played, when me and Don played Oak Hill a couple weeks ago, I wanted, because I was going to talk, I knew I was going to talk about it a bunch on the podcast, I wanted to play from the tips, from the PGA tees, which they had set up. So it's going to be, I think, 74, 76. Yeah. And we got to play the course in pretty close to the conditions that it would be for the PGA. They are shutting it down, I think, this month. So it was one of the final rounds before they shut it down for the PGA. Right. I drive the ball like 280-ish, 285 to 300. All of the bunkers there are from like 275 to 305. So if walked away from that course thinking, man, the guys that can carry the ball like 310, 315 in the air are going to have a huge leg up, because they have all these bunkers from like 275 to 305. I was in bunkers all day, every single hole.
Right. That That's incredible that they that it's like that, because normally nowadays I know. The modern golfs, they're you know, right at 310 to where these big guys
330 sometimes too.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Right in their landing area. I love Oak Hills, by the way. I haven't been there since 02. The second to last. I missed the last PGA there, but I worked for Rob LeBritz, who's on the senior tour right now, the Champions Tour.
Yeah, Glen Arbor. He's a pro at. Yes. Yeah. I grew up in Westchester. Yes, yeah.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah.
There's another golf course I really love. We don't go to anymore in Westchester, but
I played that earlier this summer. It's phenomenal. I don't know why you guys don't go back there. It's so good.
We've lost some of the greatest golf courses we played in the early and mid 2000s. I mean, Westchester was incredible. If you could go around there at 2 under a day, you win. You know,
so
8
good.
Under. It's so, so good. I don't know if I know the members probably didn't want it there anymore. That's probably the deal. And they kept charging the PGA Tour more and more to go there. And I think it just got to the point where TPCs were just easier for the PGA Tour to go to because they're free.
Yeah.
You know, all these country clubs that the members just don't want to give up their golf course. But yeah. As far as Oak Hills goes, that place is just a gem. It is a mint. I love that place. And again, it's a perfect place for Luke List.
It is so perfect for him. It really is.
It is. It is. And I say that a lot. It's just, if he can get to mentally and physically right on a certain week, it's special. He's incredible.
Does he have a couple favorite spots? I would imagine. I mean, I just listed some of them, I'm sure, but are there certain courses week to week where he's thinking, okay, this one is right in my wheelhouse?
Yeah, Houston, the new Houston now, Torrey, Riviera. Even though he hasn't played that great at Riviera, he still feels that that's a great spot for him. There's, you know, there's probably 10 events over the course of the year that he feels that this place is tailor made for him. It's even the places that it's funny. Even Hilton Head and places like Hartford, we played well this year. He can play well on those golf courses also.
Oh, yeah.
But also, you know, just the golf courses. And we're coming to Maui, but his first trip around Maui, that could be the most Luke List. I told him, I said, when you come into that place, there's a banner coming into the entrance that says Luke List. You know, golf course.
He's going to be hitting 380-yard drives at that course.
yes. And, you know, the par fives are going to be nothing to him. And a couple of the drivable par fours. And if he comes in there right, in mentally, physically, if he comes in there right, and that's a $20 million event this year, you know, with a limited field and no cut, I really, that could be a place for him to get his year. I'm not going to say that we're not going to do anything this fall, but that could be a place for him to win. I'm looking to win there.
Is he, I was just noticing this too. Do you guys put a ton of stock? Cause this is something we look at in my community a ton, is these different green types and how players perform on different green types. Is he his POA has been his best. I mean, it kind of makes sense. Cause I know he's a Seattle guy, but do you guys feel like that makes a huge difference? Do you generally feel like that is something maybe that we overrate, or do you really feel like some of these guys are way more comfortable on Bermuda versus POA versus Bent?
Well, back in the day, and when I say back in the day, I mean, you know, even before I was on tour, the 80s, 90s, early 2000s, the Florida boys never played well on the West Coast,
right.
Ever. And when the Florida boys went to Florida, they played incredibly well. Nowadays, these kids and these guys are so adaptive to the changing greens that it's not quite of a discrepancy as it was back then. As far as Luke goes, for some reason, he putts really well on POA.
Yeah.
You know, he spent a lot of time in California. He lived in California for a while. He seems to putt very well on POA. There is, you know, we do think about that week to week. You know, we go a lot of different grasses to Kikuyu, to, you know, past Palom in Mexico and a couple other places that we go to. It's a huge deal. You know, some guys just cannot putt Bermuda. Yeah. Some guys can't putt POA, but he seems to adapt very well to the changing conditions and the changing grasses. With the new Bermudas, the way they are, it's hard to imagine that anybody on tour doesn't putt well on Bermuda. These Champions Bermuda and the way the greens are, they're just perfect.
Yeah.
They're perfect. And with the POA, they're so unpredictable. You know, you could hit a great putt and miss it by, you know, a foot.
I think it helps worse putters on POA a little bit, because I think some of the great putters get a little frustrated and lose a little bit of their edge.
I agree 100%. 100%. I think I grew up on POA, so I mean, I love looking at POA greens.
Yeah.
They're easy to read. But you know, when you get out to Pebble Beach and if it's a wet West Coast, it could be demoralizing to these guys, to where, you know, you're at 2 feet and you look and there's a footprint and a heel print, right. And it's scary. I mean, it's scary to make a 2-footer. I had a picture. I took a picture out there at Pebble Beach a couple of years ago. And it looked like the moon. It did. I mean, the setting sun was on the green, and the green actually, it was at Monterey Peninsula, and it looked like the moon. And I was like, how on earth could anybody make a putt on this green? But you have to do it to survive the West Coast swing.
What is, I assume you're living in Augusta too. It doesn't feel like, you know, it feels like everybody's in Jupiter or Dallas or Scottsdale. How'd you guys kind of settle in there? And what's the community like down in Augusta?
I live in Maine. I'm in Maine. Luke's in Augusta.
So how often are you there? Aren't you got to be with him for a lot of the time or no?
No, when we're done, you know, he tells me where to be and I fly to where I have to be. So, we took a golf trip last year in the fall down to Augusta. We played a bunch of great golf courses with Luke and three of my friends and, Henrik Norlander. It was a great trip, but yeah, no, I don't live with near him. So, he's on his own when we're off, and when I'm off, I'm at home with my family.
Is his coach down there too?
No, his coach is in California.
Oh my gosh. I had no idea that it was, I always felt like it was kind of this one whole unit as everyone in the same place. But I guess, you know, there's so many more weeks on the road in different places that you don't really think about it. I guess it makes a little bit more sense.
Yeah. Yeah. Guys wouldn't survive if they, you know, were with their pro. I mean, BJ Singh was the only one that I know of that, you know, his caddy was from Ponte Vedra. And he lived in Ponte Vedra, and he had to work his off weeks. But the off weeks, once we're off, I'm off. You know, I'm off with my family doing our thing, and he's off with his.
Is there a good kind of camaraderie with the caddies? Are you spending a lot of time with those guys? You have a couple good friendships that you've made.
I have a lot of friends out here over the years. A lot of really good friends that I consider friends. And I have a couple of roommates that, you know, we spend a lot of, obviously we share hotels, and we used to share just regular hotel rooms back, you know, even as close as 5 years ago. Now we're doing more of like Embassy Suites, to where it has two rooms, two TVs and a living room. Because we're getting old, you know, I'm 50 years old now. I really don't want to spend every night with a bed next door to another caddy, you know. Not that I don't love these guys, because I do, but we try to spend, you know, save some money here and there during the year. But nowadays it's more about having your own space, renting houses. So I do have a couple of guys that, you know, they're my roommates, especially, you know, one guy that, you know, we've spent a lot of time together in the last 5-6 years. So yeah, there's a lot of camaraderie out here, but once the day's over, everybody goes their separate ways. You know, everybody does their own thing, you know, come home, have a couple beers and a meal, and it's to bed. It's really, it's an exhausting week. Weeks are just, especially when you're doing 3-4 in a row.
Yeah.
You know, it's exhausting.
Speaking of which, how do you feel about the new schedule? I mean, I the changes that have been made, and, you know, we can use this to dovetail. I'd be remiss not to ask you a little bit about the web stuff too, but what are your thoughts on kind of all the changes that the PGA Tour is kind of in the process of making right now?
Yeah, obviously it's great for us. You know, $20 million events, they're nice and it's great. And it's hard to say. You know, everybody says, you know, the old proactive, reactive thing, what the tour is doing.
Right.
It's going to end up working out well for guys that are in the top 50. Guys that finish in the top 50, life's going to be incredibly great for them, for us, for caddies, for players. And if you're not, if you're in the top 125 to 51, it's going to be a grind. You're going to have to, you know, there's still going to be, you know, $8-9 million events. It's not like it's going to be the Corn Ferry, but, you know, life's great for the top players. It's going to be great for the top players. And so you have to be a top player. You have got to be in the top 50 to make it worth your while. It's going to be interesting to see how it's all going to play out with Liv and who's going, who's coming, who's staying. I'm just glad I'm here right now and to see these big, huge events. $20 million no cut events are incredible. I mean, $3.6 million to a winner, you know, for a caddy, $360,000 to win. It's close to life changing. I mean, it for a year or two, it's life changing. Yeah. I mean, it's going to be interesting to see how it all pans out.
Did you have conversations with Luke about it? Was this something that was kind of ever on your radar? I mean, you don't even have to disclose anything you're not comfortable with about them kind of approaching him, but what's kind of that been like? And, you know, just with the relationships with all your people on tour week to week, I imagine everybody's talking about it just nonstop.
Yeah. With Luke, all I'm going to say about him is there was an offer and he was thinking about it. And I'm not going to lie, I was pushing him towards it. You know, I've spoken with some caddies, especially I've spoken with one today, actually, who was working this week. And he said it's caddy heaven.
They treat them. Caddies, I've heard that too. They treat them they treat the caddies incredibly over there.
Yeah, it's where caddies go to heaven. With the lawsuit, you know, when guys were moving over to Liv, there wasn't much, you know, guys weren't taking it personally. It was good, you know, it's your personal choice. It's a lot of money. These guys are getting paid to go to Liv. But then when the lawsuit came, a lot of guys started taking it really personal because, you know, the money that it costs to litigate this lawsuit is coming out of these tour players, and they're taking it personally. And, you know, it's caused a rift between these guys, the Liv players and the tour players. I don't blame them for going. I really don't. It's hard to turn down $1 million or $100 million or $80 million. It's life-changing money. And, you know, some of these guys, honestly, they don't love golf. I'm not naming any names, and I'm not saying everybody. I'm saying they're just incredibly good at what they do, but they don't love it. So I think the less they have to play for the most amount of money is a good thing for them. I think some guys like Luke said, he still enjoys the competition. He still enjoys battling to make a cut, battling to win. Because it's incredibly hard to make a cut on the PGA Tour. I mean, you have to play incredibly well to make a cut with these guys. And I know it sounds strange because there's top guys that make every single cut or you don't hardly miss a cut, but it's tough to make a cut. But there's definitely a rift between the LIV and the Tour players right now, for sure.
Did it seem like was that a tough decision? You know, was that something that, you know, he was seriously considering? Because it seems like he falls into that second category of somebody that really, really loves golf, because from a financial standpoint, you can't really argue with the LIV decision, right? But I think if you're staying, there's a bunch of other factors too, but a lot of it, I'm sure, has to do with, you know, like you mentioned with him, competition, legacy, a lot of that stuff.
Yeah. Honestly, I think if the offer was bigger, I think he would have gone. I think if it was, you know, some of that 20, 30, 40, $50 million around that, he would have gone. He really wants, he's 37. It's not like he's out of his prime. I don't think he is, at least.
No.
Especially the way golf is going now. I still think he really feels like he wants to win majors and compete in majors and compete for these big events. I don't think he's ready to go to like the showcase that LIV is. I'm not saying it's not competition. It is, but the shotgun start and stuff like that, the no world ranking points as we speak. And the way it's going right now with this lawsuit, I think there's some hard feelings out there. So I think with Luke, and trying not to speak for him because we have talked about it, but not at length and not in depth. You know, he asked me.
Well, you're a part of that decision too, obviously, you know.
Yeah, he asked me if you know, has anybody crunched the numbers, and I crunched the numbers, and I told him, I said, listen, unless you drop dead on the golf course, you're pretty much going to finish somewhere around 10th or better every single week on the LIV with no pressure to make a cut.
I'd agree with that.
You know, so the upside for Luke List on the LIV Tour is there. It just didn't happen at this moment. So we're focusing on the PGA Tour schedule, and we're focusing on trying to get, you know, to that top 50 to where it could be LIV-wise, you know, LIV-like, to where that kind of money is available to those guys, and they deserve it. It's hard to imagine these guys, most of them are in the hole, let's say, with caddy expenses and flights and family and houses. Most of these guys are in the hole about 15,000 before they even tee it up every single week on the PGA Tour. So if you go on a, you know, a 3-week miscut streak, you know, you're in the hole 45,000-50,000 traveling with your family. I'm not saying everybody flies private, but I'm saying, you know, $5,000-$6,000 round trip airfare and, you know, $7,000-$8,000 for a house for the week and the food and everything else and the caddy fees. It's a lot. These guys aren't guaranteed anything. So I think that's what this LIV is so enticing to these guys, you know, to where, you know, Harold Varner and those guys, you know, Gooch, who haven't been on tour that long, where they offered $80 million. I mean, $80 million is a lot of money. And I don't blame them at all for going, at all.
I was just going to ask, I mean, I think a lot of people like have the understanding that like, hey man, you know, like you do your thing, like that's fine. I can't really fault you for going in that scenario. But you mentioned with the lawsuit now, does it seem now like there's a bit like at the major championships this year, for example, I had a bunch of media friends that ended up going to the US Open, and they talked about, it was all anyone was talking about. Do you think that now there kind of is a little bit of a rift that, you know, between some of the guys are starting to get a little frustrated? And do they want, like, do you think that guys like Luke and other guys on the PGA Tour, do you want to see those guys in majors and stuff like that now?
I honestly think that they don't. I think the thing that upset most of these tour players, the PGA Tour players, is these guys assumed that they were going to go to live and to come back and be able to play the PGA Tour also.
Right. Have their cake and eat it too. Yeah.
Absolutely. The thing about the majors is it's driven with Augusta National. You know, when we're at the PGA, let's backtrack a little bit. At the PGA, PGA of America said that they were going to let live players play. And I think Augusta National is going to follow suit. I'm not going to say follows, like, I shouldn't say that. Augusta National is leading. And I don't think they're going to have a Masters without past champions and without the top players. They're not just going to have an also-ran tournament at Augusta National.
I agree.
So yeah.
It's an invitational too. So like even if guys aren't qualifying based on OWGR points, they choose who gets in.
Yes. And I think the USGA and RNA are all going to follow suit. And listen, I personally am fine with that. I'm fine with Dustin Johnson coming back and playing the Masters. That's absolutely, he deserves it. And the guys that, you know, have won the British, I think they fully deserve to play the Masters. Now, on the other hand, when and if they do fall out of the world golf rankings and they don't qualify, then I don't think they should be involved in the majors. I think they should earn their way back. But to move forward from this, I think what's happening now, like on the DP Tour, as these guys, they're letting them play. They're letting the live guys play. And I think these guys are ganging up on these DP tours. Like last week at Wentworth, They had all of those guys play. This week, they're all playing again. I think they're all ganging up and getting these big group of top players playing these DP Tour player events. And I think they're going to get their world ranking points unless the DP Tour stops them. It's crazy right now. I mean, golf has changed forever. It's never, ever going to be the same forever as long as Liv is involved. And I think everybody needs to sit down and talk, whether it's Jay Monahan and those guys, they need to sit down and talk. And this isn't second grade. I mean, Jay has, and I shouldn't, you know, I don't want to speak for him also, but he hasn't spoken with Greg Norman. He hasn't sat down. They've got to figure out a way that they can make this all happen together. I'm not saying play both tours. I'm saying there's got to be a way for everybody to coexist and make the majors a major. You know, it's sad. I think it's too bad what's happening now, but
it's not going, it's not going anywhere. Like that's the key point here is it's like, this isn't, you know, a lot of people talk about it as like, they're just this disruptor force. Well, you know, even if they get bored, not first of all, the money's not running out anytime soon. Second of all, even if they get bored, maybe that's in 5 to 7 years, right? Like in the short term, they've invested so much money in this and it's not going anywhere. So you can't really act like it doesn't exist anymore.
That's exactly right. That's why I don't understand why they don't just sit down and see what each other's ideas are. You know, the rumors, there's been rumors for years now, but you know, I've heard that Liv offered the PGA Tour $360 million to have some of the Liv events not in the biggest of PGA Tour events. You know what I mean? So
yeah,
I don't know if that's true or not. I have no idea. I think they were trying to coexist to where they could have a Liv event on maybe a side event on the PGA Tour so they don't clash. But I think now it's gone to the point with this lawsuit and everything. I just think it's
man, I think it's past the point of non-repair, I think, now. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I don't think Liv's going to back down at all. I think Liv's going to move forward and try to attract the top players in the world. I don't think they're going to back down to the PGA Tour at all. So it's all going to come down to the courts. You know, it stinks. I like things the way they were, but you know, we'll see how it works out. We'll see how it works out.
Well, a couple of quick questions I want to get you out of here on. Give me somebody underrated on tour. Give me somebody that you've played with a couple times that he maybe hasn't won as much, or he's an up and comer, but every time you watch him play, you're like, damn, this guy's really got it.
Yeah. Young. Is it Chase Young?
No, Cameron Young.
Cameron Young.
He's a beast.
I first saw him earlier on in this past year. I said, you know, this guy's got potential. You know, caddies, you're always looking out for who's who. And I think I know he hasn't won it, and I'm not saying he's a young up-and-comer. Well, maybe he is, but he is really special. He's an incredible player. He's all like a five-tool player. He's got the potential to be a world beater. So I think right now he is the top guy in my mind to be the next big thing.
Who is the funniest / favorite caddy?
Funniest? Let's see here. That's a tough question. I was trying to think of some of one of the off questions you might ask me today.
I know. I didn't prepare you for any of these.
and that'd be one of them. You know, caddies are a different breed. I don't know if I can think of one specific caddy offhand. I'm going to say I'm pretty funny myself. No. You know, it's caddies are, like I said, they're a special breed. They really are. And it's great to be a caddy. It's been a great life. It's given me everything that I have. But if you sit down with a group of caddies and just sit and listen to some of the stories, especially the old timers and the guys that have been out there 20, 30, I'd say 30 years. I wouldn't call myself an old timer, but the stories are incredible. You know, the Mike Hicks and the Fluffs and those guys have some incredible stories. I can't single out one guy that I think is incredibly funny, but collectively listening to caddies and their stories, it's a treat. It's really fun. It's another podcast for you to do, to have a multiple caddy podcast.
Last one. What's the best? Is there one shot that comes to mind? The best shot you ever seen him hit, or it could be anyone. Doesn't have to be Luke, Nick Taylor too. Does any one shot come to mind? Is like, oh my God, I'll never forget watching that shot.
Well, just hitting the green on 17 at Sawgrass when it's windy is an incredible shot, because you know it's the easiest shot in the world, other than that week. And
that week was what? Did he get the bad weather draw that week, by the way?
We did.
Oh my gosh. I remember that. And they sent them out after all the delays. And I think the first group out there was like Brooke, Xander, and Scotty, and every single one of them missed the green by like 20 yards.
Yeah. When it's blowing and like it was, it's the toughest shot I've ever seen. But Luke hit the shot that I remember last year at San Antonio. He drove it left on 15 at San Antonio, and he had this kind of hunched over 4-iron. It was into a howling wind from about 220. And I said, you know, I think we should play this out to the right. And he goes, no, I got this over the left. And I was like, over what? Over the left is woods and mountains and rocks. And he just, I don't know how he did it, but he hits this high towering cutting 4-iron over everything to 5 feet and makes the putt for birdie. And I'm not saying it was the most incredible shot in the world, but it was close. I don't think there's five guys on tour that could have hit that shot. But these guys amaze me every single day. I see something every single day that they can do that that the general public and, you know, 10 handicaps would never dream of being able to do. It, these guys are, they're incredible. They're incredible players. It's really, it's fun to be a part of.
What's the schedule look like for the rest of the fall? Are you guys going back to Jackson?
We are going to Jackson. We're off next week, going to Jackson. And then Luke and I are going to Long Beach, where Jamie Mulligan, his coach, lives. And we're going to spend Thursday, Friday, Saturday out there. I'm going to play. Well, we're going to play. So it's not much work, but I'm going to play at Virginia and Long Beach. And then we're going to head to Zozo in Japan. And then we fly from Japan to Congaree in South Carolina for the CJ Cup.
Yeah.
And then we get a couple of weeks off and we play Houston and Sea Island. And then we're done until Maui.
Yeah.
So, not bad.
You'll be busy this fall. No, that's a legit. Busy. Yeah. Yeah.
Busy, not too busy. We had some weeks off and some time off. So it's really a nice fall schedule. So, you know, it's all golf courses that he likes, which I'm really looking forward to. I mean, we're off to a bad start this week, but, you know, he was a little rusty.
It got kind of tough in the afternoon. I think you guys are still in it.
Yeah, I think so, too. I think, you know, he really, really took he wanted to take some time off in these 3 weeks that we were off, and he did. He didn't really touch a club for 2.5 weeks. So a little bit of rust, a little bit of rust coming off. So I expect him to have a good round tomorrow and then onward for the weekend.
Jeff, thanks so much for joining me, man. This was a blast. Well, I hope to do it again sometime, and I'll tell Don absolutely. You say hi. And it was a pleasure, man. Best of luck the rest of this week and in the fall swing. We'll be ready for you.
Thank you very
much.
I appreciate it. We'll do it anytime you want.
All right. That is it for the podcast. Special thanks to Jeff. Special thanks to RickRunGood.com. Make sure to check out my betting preview with Rick, which should be out on Tuesday afternoon. Golf.com article for all of my thoughts on the Sanderson Farms, and final DraftKings article on Wednesday as well. We will be back next week for the Shriners. Best of luck with your bets this week, and we'll see you next time. Cheers.
If I ventured in the slipstream between the viaducts of your dream, where mobile steel rims crack and the dead center back road stop.